know what really makes us mad? Is wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Tell them about punk!
What's up, posers? Welcome to Funk Loader Pod. I am your co-host, Justin Hensley.
And I am your co-host, Dylan Hensley. Happy 100th birthday!
And, this is our 100th episode. We've been doing this for a little over 2 years now.
Yeah, for some reason.
Yeah, the show has changed.
Suckers keep listening.
It's changed quite a bit. It started as just you and me alone, and being meaner to records than we probably should have been, which results in more negative reviews than positive. No, we still have more positives, but yeah. Well, actually, written reviews, no, we don't.
No.
But I don't know. We were trying to, I don't know.
Our dedication to a gimmick did not yield great results.
Yeah, it started as completely random, but was it even really completely random?
I'm trying to remember.
The very first episode that we lost was the Bouncing Souls, and what was that Japanese pop punk band's name?
I don't remember.
Something with Brownie in the name.
Yeah.
I don't even remember if we were like, no, let's do that Bouncing Souls album instead of whatever was originally given to us.
No, I think we just might have just kept redrawing until we got something that seemed appropriate. Anyway.
A band we heard of.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we did that for...
too long.
Yeah, 40-something episodes without any guests, really. Excluding the Fest episode, the first Fest episode, which was, like, episode 10 with Corey and Lauren. And then we did another one at Fest 18 as well. Then Corey, who is probably our most repeat guest on the show, speaking of, has he been on at all this year?
It's been a while.
Wow. I'm trying to remember the last time he was on. Yeah. No, he was in February with Adam and his package and MXPX. That's right.
Yeah.
So we need to get you back, Corey. Second guest most frequently is probably Anne Lepore from the Machine Shop. Love talking with Anne. Her episodes are always fun. And on the longer side.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, when we all get together, it's just something where we just keep talking. And plus, she's got so many really cool stories from like growing up in New York and the punk scene and all that. So
I think having Anne on the show was where I started liking doing the show.
She was on early on.
Yeah, she was one of our first guests, and it was a realization like, hey, we can talk to total strangers about punk rock and have a meaningful conversation, and it doesn't have to be like, I gotta one-up you with obscure facts, and, you know, we just had fun, and that's been my favorite part of doing this show, is to just get totally different reactions to different records and hear from our guests.
Yeah.
Trade stories, and not necessarily geek out, though occasionally.
Yeah, the first handful of guests were all our friends already. Like, we had Grant McCracken from Bitter Melody Records, we had John Russell from Gnawing, who we've had on twice now, and our friends Corey and Lauren. I think the first, like, stranger we had on the show was Paul DiCiccio from Tor Johnson. Paul's great. His stuff is amazing. The record label's cool. His shirt company's amazing. And, like, just really fun guy to talk to. Like, making friends has kind of been the best part about this show. I mean, kind of, but really has been the best part of the show.
Yeah, I think so. I think it reminds me of, you know, being a punk kid on Tumblr and just meeting like-minded people that way. I don't know. It's the community aspect of punk rock that is often more difficult to achieve by just randomly going to shows than it is often presented for some extremely introverted people.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you go to shows, most people are with their group of friends anyway. So the average person isn't even really trying to make new friends when they go to a show. Unless they're just, like, the most extroverted person who's all about making friends. But I'm very happy to call a lot of these people friends. Adam Yo, who we talk about a lot, just an all around fantastic person, funny, knowledgeable, great writer. I've gotten to know, I've found bands through his writing, and who wound up becoming guests. So that's why a lot of times I'll talk about Adam. It's because the band that we're talking to, I heard because he wrote about it, or it was another No Echo writer, but his writing makes me go to that page. And then even just some other, like, Josh and Sarah for Self-Aware and All Right, you know, we've known them for a while, but it was fun to get to know them better through the podcast.
Yeah, to have a sustained conversation beyond the, hey, how are you, you know, passing each other at shows and at Fest, and to actually get to know more about their experiences in punk and their tastes in music.
Having Zia Hilty on was a lot of fun the two times we've had her on. She's just so funny. Skagus basically is a thing because of we got to do the one with Zia. Fellow podcasts like Singles Going Steady, Angry Girl, Scott from Fly on the Call, who just got signed. I don't know how you do that with podcasts. He's on now a podcast network with some like real big names like the Punk Rock NBA and Axe to Fall. Like, these are big names. So it's amazing Scott got that opportunity. And then like out of nowhere, the Hard Times guys, like Matt and Bill, that was crazy. Just got an email from his booker or from their
publicist
for the book. And like hell yeah, I want to talk to them. Not to mention all of the, I can't forget Steve Dozen and Dave Brown, the bloggers. It's like all these different aspects of punk music that we personally love. You know, we ran multiple blogs before we started this show. We had message boards we even started. We were in bands.
Yeah. I love talking to label people. I love talking to, you know, the people that don't get to talk often in the public sphere of punk rock, the people who are usually behind the scenes. It's been really fun to get their perspectives. They're usually a little meaner. If they don't like something, they'll say it. But all the great bands too that we've gotten to talk to. I mean, Elise from Oceanator, Jeff and Katrina from Expert Timing,
Katie and Rena from Bacchae.
Yeah,
of course. Andrew Verdecchio of Five Iron Frenzy, Body Farm, you know, Ocean and Eric, and Akil from End It. Like, it's just like people that I tweeted this last week, maybe, where I said the best thing about this show is just being able to message or tweet at a band and ask them, hey, do you want to do this show? And most of the time they say yes. And if they don't say yes, they just don't respond. So it's not a no. But it's just amazing that you just be like, hey, you want to come talk about something? Like something cool that you like or want to laugh about?
Yeah.
The show has grown quite a bit. I think we have finally got, I don't know, we're always changing things though.
Yeah, well.
But we've got as close to a groove that I think we're going to sustain for a while. Yeah. So thank you for being a guest on the show. If we mentioned you or if we didn't mention you, we've had a lot of people on. Thank you for listening. If you've been listening all along, that's incredible. We would love to hear from you. And even those people who just like steadily, you know, download every week and don't say anything to us, like,
yeah, thanks for bearing with us as we figured it out. I hope that regular listeners feel rewarded for sticking with us, especially since we've been back in the post-COVID world, after our little break, mental health break, it's been especially rewarding to me personally. I feel since we've been back to feel like our perseverance is paying off. So I hope that other listeners are getting that out of it too. That the conversations are getting better, the insights are smarter and funnier, and maybe you hear yourself in them, relatable. I hope that we can continue to build on that. It's crazy that we've been doing this for 2 years.
It still feels like we just started it in some ways. Maybe it's just this feeling of like never being sure what you're doing is working. And so you're constantly, like, adjusting and changing things. So, yeah, it's very, I almost think the show didn't start until we started having guests on every single week. Like, the one-offs were fun, because they were our friends, but, like, to me, the show didn't even feel real until, like, around episode 48, when, like, we started our string of guests every week. So,
yeah, there will be many more twists and turns. I'll message Justin a dumb holiday-related pun, and we'll do a weird genre tangent episode or a month of gimmicks, or we've got a couple of other ideas similar to the bracketology episodes that we have been cooking on the back burner that hopefully in our third year we'll figure out how to execute those in a way that is enjoyable to listen to and not 5 hours long.
Yeah. Those singles action episodes are really fun to research and listen to, or the music for, but I don't know how enjoyable they are to listen to as just a podcast. So we have to figure out a way to make that not 5 hours long.
Yeah. This would be a good point to plug our phone number and our email address, so you can send us some feedback. What do you like about the show? Drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we have an email address as punklottapod@gmail.com. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Facebook is weird and awkward, so definitely reach out through Instagram or Twitter. Those work way better. I've booked show episodes through those platforms. But even if you want to have your voice possibly heard, call our voicemail line. It's 202-688-PUNK, and I've never really remembered what the numbers are that make punk. That's 202-688-7865.
Yes.
So I need to write that down so I can always have that. But here's something that we can do. We started asking, and we've actually forgot to ask Jay Gonzo last week, but we've been asking our guests what charities they like to donate to, and because the world seems to have some awful thing happen to it nearly every day, and for those of us who feel like we should do something, even if it's not physically being able to go to like a protest or something like that, you could still give money to really good places. So I guess we could even say some of our personal favorites. Favorites is a weird way to put it, but the one thing that I support the most frequently is Charlotte Uprising. They are a jail bond service, and they also provide a lot of jail service for people who've been released on bail. They have been fighting the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department system for months now, but they are doing some really, really good work. You can go to their Instagram. They're not an official organization in the sense that they're not registered as like a whatever tax number that you're supposed to have along those lines. It's really basically just a series of Venmos, and they tend to have the most up-to-date post will be the most recent, or the place where they're taking money. There's a lot of Venmos, but I have given multiple times to them, and I've never felt like it wasn't going somewhere good. So Charlotte Uprising is my number one place that I support. Do you have any?
We've donated a few times, water and supplies and things to Phoenix Mutual Aid. I would highly recommend that you look up a mutual aid in your city, figure out if there's a place that you can take, perishables and non-perishables. The Navajo Nation was especially hit hard by COVID, and I think it's really, really, really important to contribute where possible. I don't have any specific orgs on the top of my head, but easy to research and find. I want to plug, if you're in Arizona, if you're in the Phoenix area, if you're listening to the show, you're probably aware of, POTR in Action and Black Lives Matter Phoenix. They keep me pretty much up to date on everything that's happening. And there's also No More Deaths, which is a great organization that is constantly on the Mexico-Arizona border, just trying to provide humanitarian aid and routinely being raided by Border Patrol. They could definitely use any money that you're going to throw their way, what they're doing is life-saving work. And it's really, really, really important. And it's a pretty shameful thing that happens pretty regularly to their organizers. So give where you can. I know all of our regular listeners, I'm sure you're pretty woke and plugged in. Keep at it, please. This is going to be an ongoing.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you notice, you've already noticed at this point, we don't have a guest today. It's because we had a really dumb idea.
Oh, yeah.
It's thanks. Up there. We put out a post asking for people to make suggestions for what we should do for our 100th episode, and we had a couple responses, but the most concrete one was from Dave Brown, Oklahoma lefty. He told us, you should do a top 100, since it's the 100th episode. And we were like, okay, how do we do that? So the way we came up with it is we're going to talk about 100 albums in 100 minutes. And basically that just means you have 1 minute to talk about the album. So we're going to have timers. And do you have your timer on your phone ready to time me whenever it's... So basically, the timer will start when we start talking about the record. And then we'll, if we don't finish before the minute's up, then we'll be interrupted with a stop. Time's up. Just a big old, like, sound effect. But I guess we should mention, like, talk about what this list is. And there's not one thing that this list is. The way I looked at it, it's probably, at least my half of the list, is my favorite albums that by primarily punk or punk-related bands that we haven't talked about on the show extensively. Like, we haven't devoted an entire episode to, or, like, a really long portion of an episode to. And maybe aren't the most well-known records. A lot of my stuff feels more under the radar. It just feels like personal favorites is kind of how I'm looking at this list. So it's not like this list isn't like, this is definitively the best punk records of this, you know. It's just more of my personal taste.
Yeah, I wouldn't even try to approach some sort of objective standard. My portion of the list, we're not going to do 100 each. Good Lord, that would take forever. We split them in half. There's a couple of them names that are going to be familiar that we've talked about, but I feel like they're bands that I can talk about constantly. So all of these records are pretty much records that I have listened to a ton in the last 5 years. Some of these, you know, go back further for me, but I felt like I wanted to be a little more current with my tastes, and not necessarily talk about, you know, the records that I've listened to the most. If I haven't listened to a record in 5 or 6 years, you know, it was important at one point in my life, but these are the records that I think are still resonating with me.
Yeah, my list is more of mostly like my all-time favorite stuff. Mine's a little bit more just throughout my entire life. A lot of these I haven't listened to since besides like the researching for this episode. But these are also the kind of records that I could talk about without having to have listened to it again. That's basically how I approached it. So we kind of have different stuff. Either way, these are 100 records that we like. And I think we both like each other's list pretty much the same. Maybe wouldn't include specific albums because we didn't want to repeat a lot of artists. There are some minor repeats, but we'll mention them when we get there.
And I guess to explain maybe the methodology of the ranking of these records, we both put together our individual lists of 50 and submitted them to each other. And then we looked at where we had overlapping selections. Those all got bumped to the top, whether it was the same artist or they're even the same exact album of the same artist. We didn't want to do all 4 Jawbreaker records or, you know, like we wanted to limit ourselves. We didn't want to repeat ourselves a ton on the list. So I feel like this represents a very broad sampling of our taste. And then I think it's, you know, after the top something like 12 or so, the rest of it is just kind of our own individual takes and not necessarily the overlapped on. I did plenty of overthinking on this list, but I did not try to overthink the order that these records are in. My selections are based almost entirely on just how much I listened to them. That kind of dictated their placement. So
yeah, this is a list that in 2 months, if you ask us to make another 100, it might be 50% different, you know.
Yeah,
so
I might listen to some classic record that everyone's been telling me to listen to for 10 years for the first time and go, wow, this is amazing.
They were right all along.
Yeah. There's a couple of those on here, but I think it's going to be a fun list. I hope you get something out of it. If there's, one of the great things about doing this show is a lot of times getting that perspective from another person makes me like a band more. I mean, the episode we did with Dave, Oklahoma Lefty, we talked about All. I had an entirely different perspective of All going into that episode, and we listened to that record and we talked about it, and I have so much more love and respect for that band now. So some of these names you might be like, I hate them. Maybe we can change your mind.
Yeah. So I guess without anything else, we'll start the list. I have number 100, so I'll go first. I guess you could start the timer when I'll say the number. And when I say the number, then you can start the timer. So we'll do it that way.
Okay.
So, all right. Everybody ready? We got all our stuff. Okay. all our stuff. Okay. Number 100, I have Armalite by Armalite. Was a super group of Philadelphia legends made up of Adam Gorin of Adam and His Package, Dr. Dan Yemen from Painted Black and Lifetime, Mike McKee from Kill the Man in Questions, Jeff Ziga from Affirmative Action Jackson. It was released on No Idea Records in 2006. This is one of my all-time favorite hardcore records. I like this record almost more than any other project most of these musicians have been in, except for maybe one or two. It's more melodic than you'd expect from all of these musicians together. But, I mean, I guess Adam ties it together. He is very melodic with Adam and His Package. But they didn't release much else, just a 7-inch called Humongous. But I throw this record on pretty regularly. And I have yet to see them live at Fest, but maybe it'll happen again someday. I don't know. Not sure. But, yeah. That was pretty much exactly the amount. So let me get mine ready.
All right.
Ready when you are.
So mine at number 99, I have Beach Slang and their EP, Who Would Ever Want Anything So Broken. I sometimes wish that Beach Slang had only turned in their first two EPs and then evaporated into the night. The peek behind the curtain into James Alex's excessive replacements worship, though it can't tarnish the impact of this EP. It's like the Goo Goo Dolls meets Jawbreaker. Achy romantic fixations and fuzz and reverb and Brit poppy guitar lines. I love just the rolling tide of feedback that rolls through this EP. For me, at 25, I really felt stuck in the mud. I was burned out on heavy music that was still really heavily populating my daily listening activity. The emo revival fixation was yielding weaker results every year. But then these searingly earnest, noisy pop-punk tunes came buzzing out of the sky and made me fall in love with punk rock all over again. I told you I overthought it.
This is going to be fun. We decided, too, we're not going to do a ton of commentary on each other's picks, unless it's just like something we have to say. But, yeah, I think I probably didn't write enough for most of these. But All right. At number 98, I have Forming. Another self-titled. The 6-song EP was released on Vitriol Records in 2010. This features members of Ghost Limb and Warm Thoughts. Forming were an alternative rock slash emo band. The label is mostly known for hardcore, so this was kind of a cool sidestep for Vitriol. I adore these songs so much. John Russell from Gnawing is one of the only other people I know who loved this band as much as me. They only released another EP called Sleep Like a Dog and a handful of comp tracks. These songs are like kind of melancholy, but they're also endearingly sweet. I think the song Stay Home is a masterpiece. I wish we could have got at least one full-length album from them, though the lead singer Neil did release a bunch of alt-country records that sort of fits the vibe of Forming, if you're interested in those. But yeah, this is just... Yeah.
I'm the other person.
Yeah. There's three of us.
All right.
Hold on. Let me get the clock real quick. I don't know why it went away.
At okay. Number 97, I have Young Widow's Old Wounds. I really kind of love it when a band's influences can be clearly delineated and dissected, but the results surpass that pastiche and worship. And Young Widow's sophomore record really fits the bill. It's every bit the sum of the Melvins and Jesus Lizard and Unsane and Nick Cave and Shipping News and so on and so forth. But it surpasses most of those bands for me. It's a punishingly dark and disturbing sounding record, but without all of the amphetamines and perversion that is kind of associated with noise rock. To me, the addiction is purely sound and brain shaking high decibels and swampy echo and dizzying tremolo. This record has live takes interspersed throughout it, and they would almost be indistinguishable.
You overthought it.
Yeah.
I underthought it. Perfect. We're perfect for this show. Usually it's the other way around. Okay. Number 96. It is Oingo Boingo's Only a Lad. I had originally selected a different Oingo Boingo record, but after going back to that one, I was like, you know what? This just isn't the one that I go to first. Only a Lad, we talked about them a lot during our IRS bracket episode. I was going to pick another album, but I hadn't listened to them in a while. So, you know, resampling cleared that up for me. But Little Girls is on this record. It's a creepy song. You're not sure what he really is talking about. On the Outside is on here. It's amazing. Capitalism's here. This is when they were their most like Devo. But they quickly developed a sound of their own. They managed to be much more unique with their use of percussion and horns. This record's probably more punk than some of the later records, because they go more in a new wave direction, especially with like Dead Man's Party and some of the bigger stuff. But this is the one that I go to most often.
There you go. That was a good ending point. All right. You ready?
Yep.
I'm just going to have to barrel through these. Wrote too much on some of these records. At number 95, the misleadingly cleaned up sound of Signals, Calls, and Marches by A Mission of Burma. Probably made them far more influential than they likely would have been had they recorded it in their furiously loud live playing style. But these songs would have connected to me and my past Tumblr punk self, no matter how they were recorded. It's a uniquely American post-punk sounding record. The lead single, That's When I Reached for My Revolver, single-handedly could have launched the entirety of indie rock. They keep this kind of cowboy imagery throughout the EP. It's super fun. Nods to Talking Heads, disco beats, and jagged Gang of Four guitars. It's excellent, excellent songwriting and an excellent performance. This EP really laid the groundwork for a lot more of the records that I'm going to talk about on this list. So, hey, I got through that one.
Yeah. Okay, number 94, I have Merry Christmas, Her Exceptional Kindness. The most ungoogleable band on the planet. Merry Christmas is from... was from Torrance, California. I found them through the Lauren Records comp, I Think We Should Stay Away From Each Other, which features so many of my favorite bands even to this day. I think it's one of the greatest punk comps of the 2010s, maybe even the 2000s in general. This record is very short wave. I don't know what that means. It's a combination of like emo and punk bands that... Oh, okay. My notes don't make any sense. I'm losing my own time. But so this record came out during that short wave of emo and punk bands that were influenced by Superchunk and Guided by Voices before everybody decided to do Weezer. This is like a fuzzy punk record that's more in the vein of Joyce Manor and Summer Vacation, but it's a little more experimental, which typically I don't like, but this works just perfectly for me. The experimentation's... Yeah. Lost my own time.
He stumbled there, but almost made it.
Oh, man.
This seemed like it was going to be a bear, but it's a little bit more fun. Now that we're in it. Yeah. All right. At number 93, here's a classic, Patti Smith's Horses. This debut record is still so jarring to me. Patti Smith is a singular voice in all of music history. She's got no true peers in her prime. She influenced so many bands. Immediately, she draws out this beat poetry across Velvet Underground style, three chord rock, faux reggae, and jazz fusion soundscapes, folk pop, danceable proto new wave. She was a brilliant artist in her own right, and on this debut, she's pushed to the extreme by John fucking Cale, which really launched her into a string of records that is like Bob Dylan's first couple Electric records or Neil Young's Ditch period. Really exciting, raw sounding music that transcends genre. I mean, it's hailed as a proto-punk.
I wonder if people are going to be like, they didn't finish their thought. Nope, that's the rules. That's what makes this fun. All right. Number 92 is Sinsfield and their album Building. This is mid-90s Revelation Records emo. It's probably one of my favorite sounds in punk. They're hardcore punk dudes writing melodic rock songs. Doesn't happen enough for me. And so, like, Sinsfield, Game Face, 100 other bands I can't think of because I didn't write them down in my notes. It's This was their second full-length album and the one that got them signed to a major label. Then the band sat on their the label sat on their record until 2000, ruining any momentum they were developing. John Bunch passed away a couple years ago, unfortunately. He's one of my all-time favorite vocalists in punk music. His For the Seems Forever record is great. War Generation were so much fun, and they could have been so much bigger. Chris Evenson and Rodney Sellers' driving guitars here are so bittersweet. This record and Killed for Less are probably my favorite Sinsfield albums before they switched to a more Midwestern emo sound, but... Ooh, there.
All right. At number 91, the Super Weeks debut EP, The World is a Terrible Place and I Hate Myself and Want to Die, piqued my interest with its title alone. I thought it was hilarious that a band would make such a blatant jab at emo's most ubiquitous, at least at the time, band. The opening track, Night Swimming at the Full Moon Party, it really commits to the joke with this kind of post-emo sound and slow strummed chords. And it's got this big major crescendo, and it's an excellent song. It's an excellent EP. The rest of it hints at early Weaker Thans and Teenage Fan Club style power pop. Just chock full of sweet melodies and tasteful guitar licks, which would be their bread and butter going forward. A band that too many people have slept on, but seeing them at Fest really clenched them for me. It's Doc and Evan.
Great. Okay. Number 90, Seaweed with Spanaway. This is the other band I was thinking of. I should have just looked down. But Punk Dudes Writing Melodic Songs. This was their major label debut. After a couple Sub Pop records, they signed to Hollywood Records, of all places. We talked to a couple times about how Hollywood is this weird label that is owned by Disney, and yet they signed these like non-Disney band. I mean, I guess it's Hollywood operates on its own. Regardless, all the things I said about driving guitars, Seaweed does that even more so than Sinsfield. Spanaway is their third full-length album, and I think it's one of their least popular, but I love it. I find that the hooks are so massive on this record. The first two tracks, Free Drug Zone and Crush Us All, that's one of the best 1-2 song intros of the 90s. Plus, that Green Liner album cover is just so iconic. I can't help thinking of that cover whenever I...
Okay. At number 89, I picked Nowhere by Ride. I think I like shoegaze best when it's got a healthy dose of other influences, and that's really evident here. To me, this record is better than Loveless or Souvlaki combined. Neo-psychedelic squalls and filter sweeps and this tireless, like, spiritual jazz drumming style throughout the record. It's a killer record. Hypnotic bass lines and really, really well-crafted melody. And just these great glossy vocal harmonies that ebb and flow throughout. To my ears, it's like Laurel Canyon Rickenbacker Chime meets post-Sid Mead, pre-Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd, Tape Echo, and cranked high headroom amps. It's just a gorgeous sounding record. And I couldn't help but pick it up hearing it in the record store.
Okay, number 88 is my dumbest selection. It is Shockwaves, The Ultimate Doom. It's a Transformers hardcore band. They are one of my favorite hardcore bands, period. It's the epitome of a gimmick band. It's not even super tied to its gimmick, other than maybe the lyrics are just about destruction in general. So the band is from the point of view of the Decepticons, Transformers. They're a super group made up of members of X-Disciple X, Known as a Victim, The Deal, and 100 other, like, hardcore bands. They've got, like, 5 vocalists, and, like, they all wear masks and go by code names. So there's not a lot of information as far as who is on these records. You can tell Dave Quiggle is doing the vocals on this record, especially if you compare it to his Dodging Bullets and Jesus Web stuff. But this is their slickest record. It came out on Triple Crown. And then I chalked the Face Down Fest DVD for making me a fan for life of this album.
All right. Number 87. This is a big nerd record, but I genuinely love it. It's Power Corruption Lies by New Order. I know you're sick and tired of people telling you to listen to it, but you really should listen to it. It's great. I'm not just saying that because I want credit for holding some widely held critical position. It's catchy, and the synths sound super cool. For a few weeks last year, the YouTube algorithm kept recommending me different live takes of the opening track, Age of Consent. And I would click on it every time because I'm a sucker. One, because it's a great song, and that bass line and the chord progression are just pure bliss. But two, because I got a little chuckle out of seeing Bernard Sumner botch the guitar lead in almost every single one. It's just something so endearing to me about seeing a successful artist like that not play his instrument well. But it's just a cool record.
Just a cool record. All right, number 86 is The Fake Boys' Pig Factory. Pig Factory brings to memories a very specific point in my life. It's going to shows and hanging out with our friends from Hickory and in Asheville. This is when we were the most active in our, like, quote-unquote local scene, even though I had to drive an hour and a half to get to it. This was one of the two albums that I had on constant rotation in 2012. The Fake Boys are from Lowell, Massachusetts. They play this melodic punk rock with gigantic riffs, to the point that when you see them live, they are one of the loudest bands you will ever see. But they also have these insanely catchy melodies. They're not a band that a lot of people love, but I've always had a special place in my heart for them, just for time and place, and it's tied into another record on my list very closely. But I had enough for that one.
All right, number 85 is Cheers Missing by Wire.
No blind blind spots in the leopard's eyes can only help to jeopardize the lives of lambs that shepherd cries. An afterlife for a silverfish, eternal dust, less ticklish than the clean room a house guest wears. He lies on his side as he tries to hide the fact he'd see up, which is nonsense, but he lies on his side as he tries to hide.
To me, it's a better record than Pink Flag. Maybe that's sacrilege. I don't know. It's a grower for most people, but to me, it was instantly engaging, more than their debut. Heavy influences from Brian Eno and Can and Kraftwerk. It's like a collage more than it is a collection of full-fledged songs. There's just tons of echoes that build up and run away, and these carnival-esque close interval melodies and funky bass lines. It's equally playful and really menacing in a way that reminds me of early Devo, but without all the theatrical campiness. But then after 10 songs of mostly texture and mood building, we get Outdoor Minor, an elegant pop gem that leads into this crampsy, hyper-short, slapback echoed riffing on I Am the Fly, and it's weird.
Seems like you had a lot more to say on that one, but
yeah.
Number 84 is Beloved, Failure On. Beloved, Beloved, or Beloved Us, or Beloved US. We were all confused whenever that change happened, but this is the first band that I felt home pride for. They're from Kernersville, North Carolina, and learning they were a North Carolina band was really big for me. They were included on the This Is Solid State Volume 4 CD-DVD combo that I chalk up to getting me into heavy music. The guy who worked at the Lifeway Christian Bookstore told me to buy it, and then when I tried to say, what about this one? He said, just buy the comp. Like, he was right, because it introduced me to all my favorite bands for the next 3 years. Only Our Faces Hide was on that CD, and the video for Aimless Endeavor was on the DVD. So this combination of like clean sung and shouted hardcore vocals was something that was very common in the scene, but Josh and Joe have such a distinct voice compared to the rest of those bands. Joe is like straight up a hardcore vocalist, and Josh is... Oh, fuck, I had a lot more too.
Maybe we should include a link to our notes so people can hear the rest of our thoughts. No one's going to read that. Number 83, I picked No Depression by Uncle Tupelo. Uncle Tupelo reinvented country music for kids who thought they didn't like country music when country music didn't sound very much like it used to. They kind of took this Steve Earle hillbilly Springsteen sound and then cranked it up through these garage rocky loud amps and really beat the shit out of their drums. To me, this is more of a punk record than it is a country record. I just listen to the beat and those big chunky riffs, but there's plenty of country moments, true country moments. I mean, a cover of a Carter Family song, and Whiskey Bottle wheels out some pedal steel. But all in all, I love the sloppiness, the overactive bass and drums, and this faux honky-tonk attitude. It really launched 1,000 ships, and theirs is probably still the best. That's all I've got. I think I said it all.
Yeah. Not a punk record.
Yeah, one of my questionable selection.
Yeah. All right. At number 82, we have 90-pound Wuss, Shorthand Operation. This is the third and final 90-pound Wuss record. It's also their best. This record features the addition of John Spaulding. He did join the band on the previous record with a meager die of self-interest halfway through the record, and it changed that band's 90-pound Wuss sound for good. This is the only album he appears on the entire record for, and he added so many like sounds and synths and effects on his guitars and textures. Matt Johnson from Blenderhead and Roadside Monument also joined this record. Jeff Suffering isn't what you would call a good singer, but he pulls it off on this record. It's kind of in the vein of the more experimental Refused songs and then some Nation of Ulysses. They got better with every record, and this was their last, so they went out on a high note. John Spaulding also passed away, and R.I.P. John.
Similar, sort of in the same lane here at number 81. I picked the Battered Brains EP, New Era, Hope Colony, because well, I could have picked any number of Sarah Kirsch bands, but every December I spin quite a few of her records in honor of her passing. And almost invariably, I start with this EP. There's just something about it that really clicks for me. She took all these experimental leanings from Please Inform the Captain, This is a Hijacked, and really perfected them. You've got these funky, spacey sound collages and slashed in between these blasting, lo-fi, furious, experimental hardcore. It's like Sandinista-era Clash vibes with D-Cruisin' effects, heavy thrash, and West Coast emo core all taken to the extreme. This record includes Jose Palvox from Swing Kids and Spencer Rangich from Bullets In and Sarah's other band.
We'll talk about her again later.
Yeah.
All right, number 80 is Cursed One.
They talk about acts of murder, blood, cutting, mutilating, children, bodies, body parts, limbs, eyes, hearts, entrails, and
we're talking serious stuff. Yeah.
We all know the Cursed story. They churned it out for years. They released 3 albums, a couple EPs, had a catastrophic tour in Europe that broke the band up. They never reunited, and then immediately gained a cult following that inspired an entire wave of hardcore bands in the late 2000s, early 10s. Fronted by hardcore legend Chris Callahan from Left 4 Dead, The Swarm, Ruination, Countdown to Oblivion, Mature Situations, Burning Love, and Sect, Cursed became a touchstone for every hardcore band in the next 5 years after they broke up, including our own. No one had quite blended this type of hardcore, crust, thrash, black metal, and entombed riffs in this way. I picked one because it's the first one, and it may be the best one, but all three are amazing. So I'm ready for this type of hardcore to come back in style because it's the most fun I had during this being in a hardcore scene. But yeah, Cursed, amazing. Wow.
We're in a pretty heavy portion here. At number 79, I've got New Lexicon by Paint It Black. That record played for me as a young punk like a last cathartic fuck you to the Bush administration. It was like saying, I hope the door hits your ass on the way out and breaks your fucking back. I didn't know then that it would come to mean a lot more. jump forward 8 more years, I listened to this record on Inauguration Day instead of watching those proceedings. I learned a lot in those intervening years, and Paint It Black is a large part of that education. This record is full of breakneck riffs and speed and Dan Yemen just destroying his voice. I really hope that someday this record is not so relevant, but I will be yelling myself hoarse along with it every time.
Number 78 is Old Fling's Spite. No band has actually impacted my real life more than Old Fling's. We were at their first show. We were at their first video shoot. You can see us in the background in one shot. I booked in the place shows. We played shows with them. We went to more of their shows than probably any other band I've ever seen live. We were at their last show at Fest. And I was at their reunion show last year. I love this record. I love this band. I know the people in this band. I love the Matt Evans, Jordan Luff, Travis Holyfield, Springs Wade. Springs took over after Travis. Long Live the Broken Heart. It's just, I don't know if I can even talk about the music. It's Sam I Am worship at its core, but it's just so criminally underrated and underheard. You need to listen to this record.
Yeah. I mean, it's everything you wanted Sam I Am worship to be. Long Live the Broken Heart. All right. At number 77, this one's kind of surprised that it made it on the list for me, but it is Lurid Traversal of Route 7 by Hoover. Often compared, as a DC band, inevitably to Fugazi. But to me, it sounds more like California. It sounds like Oakland's Indian Summer or some of the San Diego bands like Swing Kids and Drive Like Jehu. You've got songs like Electrolux with this jazzy, quiet playing and an absurdly fuzzy bass that just revs up into this mid-song trumpet gilded crescendo. Tons of feedback and angularity and everything that you want post-hardcore to be. Tons of atmosphere, distant shouting, brass repeatedly.
Is this number 76 is Lemuria's Get Better. When Lemuria got big, they became the band that every female-fronted, vaguely punk-slash-indie rock band would be compared to. Part of this is misogyny. Part of this is just straight-up laziness. But it shows you how big Lemuria were. Get Better and First Collection are the must-have albums by them. First Collection is a compilation, of course. But when Pebble came out, a lot of fans were disappointed. A lot of fans were disappointed. And it's not to say it's a bad record, but it's just very dark and different from the more upbeat tunes of Get Better. They managed to stick around with a very dedicated fan base up until their recent hiatus. I don't know that they're done, but they're not playing shows. I don't know what it is now. But they helped pave the way for women in punk and indie slash DIY, whatever that sound became. And they're the part of the inspiration for the modern DIY sound.
Okay. And number 75, it's that snare sound. You know which one. Progression Through Unlearning, the second and best record by Snapcase. For this episode, and I just wanted to get up and windmill across my living room floor listening to Caboose. This record is a monster. Helmet and Dead Guy grooves, contort Earth Crisis metalcore formula. Daryl Taberski's open-throated roar is incredible. Got venomous bass lines and swirling guitars, and of course Tim Redman's drums. They don't just sound incredible, he plays like a sewing machine. Just an incredible hardcore record. I read that they would test these songs out live to make sure the kids would really go off before they committed them to the record. I think the kids went off. This is a killer hardcore record.
Number 74 is Sincere Engineer's Rhombithian. Rhombithian? I don't know how to say this word. this is one of the newer... Rhombithian. It's one of the newer albums on my list. Sincere Engineer have no other music. Well, they have some songs here and there, but this is their lone album. It kind of blindsided me when I heard it for the first time. I think it had been out for a year. I can't think of a song that gave me chills for how good it was on the first listen since I heard Corn Dog Sonnet number 7. Seeing them at Fest was absolutely incredible. The entire room was singing along with them, and it's amazing how quickly people have connected to this record. I know they're destined to be huge once the second album is finally unleashed, assuming there's not any backlash due to Sophomore Slump, blah, blah, blah. I'm not wishing that upon them. I'm just hoping for an amazing follow-up, but in the meantime, this record is just a perfect solo one record that a band has released. I was doing them, yeah.
All right, coming in at number 73 is In This Mess by Toy Guitar. One morning at my contract car loan scanning job, I plugged my headphones in, started scrolling through Bandcamp looking for something to take up some of my time, And this album cover jumped out at me on the new punk releases chart, and my hair was blown back pretty hard. I revisited it a few times that week, which is unusual for me. And that was before I even realized it was Jack Dalrymple of Dead to Me, other bands I'm blanking on right now. I mean, it's like 60s surf rock and 70s Stooges and New York Dolls kind of rock and roll slop. And Jack's just awesome voice. He sounds like a smoked out, tuneful Iggy Pop. He spits out these sticky verses and choruses, really committing to an aesthetic. It's been one of my favorite records for the last 5 years.
Number 72 is Rollins Band Wait. Jay Gonzo talked a lot of shit on Henry Rollins last week. we are a pro Henry Rollins podcast. He's a goof. We know it. He's a meathead, sure, but he's a smart meathead. This is one of only two essential post-Black Flag musical albums you should listen to by Henry Rollins. Some of his spoken word is pretty great. He transitioned into spoken word and acting. So when he formed Rollins Band to play, he formed the Rollins Band to play some aggressive as hell groove metal. Wait is the fourth album after the enormous End of Silence, and this album features the famous song Liar, which got MTV play and appeared on Beavis and Butthead. But this record also features Disconnected and Civilized, which are two outstanding songs. Henry Rollins is a controversial figure in hardcore and punk, but he's a good front man. You can't discount that. Stumble over my own writing again.
Yeah. At number 71, I picked A Thousand Surfaces by Hard Girls. Oh, Lord. This is going to be a long episode. I could have picked any number of Mike Huguenot records. I could have picked Shinobu, any other Hard Girls record, but I think this is the one I spent the most time with. Hard Girls has got like 1,000 great guitar parts. Just these buzzing, busy guitar lines that weave in and out. The bass and drums are just in perfect lockstep. It's a killer, crunchy, power pop, punk, indie rock, whatever you want to call it record. I think that it really owes to their dedication to give any idea a go. If it's a good idea, they made it work. So it's just this crazy jigsaw puzzle of math rock and jazz and surf and funk and punk and rock.
Number 70 is Castavet's Summer Fences. I've been begging Count Your Lucky Stars for years on the internet to press Summer Fences on vinyl, whether it be on Tumblr or Twitter or Instagram. It's the first Castavet album before they were forced to change their name to No Vowels, so CSTVT, because doing the Reviver thing. It is my favorite emo revival record. They avoided being jokingly tagged the twinkly shit thing. They were not nearly as Kinsella worshipy due to their big influence from Small Brown Bike and Hot Water Music. So they recently activated their Instagram account. So I'm hoping that this means something is going to happen with Castavet soon. I'll press this record on vinyl, please. Or a new record. I'm happy with a new record too, but I love this record. That's all I got to say.
There we go. All right. Number 69 is Tenements' Napalm Dream. I've seen this band twice in my life. The first was at Fest. They had a 45-minute time slot. They used less than half of it. I saw them again at Lunchbox Records, and they played less time than the countryside band Dusk that opened for them. I still vividly remember watching the man with the saxophone on the side of the stage through that whole set, just waiting for him to rip into a killer solo. And he does, at the very last song, skronk out just a sheet of sound. I mean, it wasn't musical, but it was one of the most exciting things I've ever seen. Usually I hate that kind of thing, but here it works. Napalm Death, is stunning record. It's beautiful, noisy, catchy, powerful.
Okay, number 68 is Blaster the Rocket Man, The Monster Who Ate Jesus. Many of you are going to go, who? What? They are one of the oddest Christian punk bands ever. Blaster never signed with any of the bigger Christian record labels. They were only on Boot to Head and Jackson Rubio. And so you have to know your deep cut Christian punk to understand what those labels are all about. This was their third album, and it is their best sounding as far as songwriting is concerned and production. Their brand of punk is inspired by the Dead Kennedys, the Dicks, and Man or Astro Man, with some hints of Devo, but they are an incredibly chaotic band, and one that I wish more people had heard before they called it quits. Some of the members would go on to start Voice of the Mysterons. Actually, it may just be Otto is the only one, but his insane vocals and delivery style and histrionics and odd spoken word parts are, yeah, nuts.
Rickard is so goofy, but I love it. All right, well, we've mentioned them a few times, but at number 67, here is Devo. And I picked New Traditionalists. I have a theory that I suggested to you previously. I think a lot of punk kids start with question, are we not men? Answer, we are Devo. And probably enjoy it. If they don't, well, they probably don't go any further. But the ones that do probably wind up a little bit disappointed by their follow-up. And then see that Freedom of Choice has Whip It on it and decide to skip out on the rest of them. But for anyone who perseveres, this is their best batch of songs. They took off their red energy domes and shined up their new Reagan-style hair helmets. The synths are perfectly tuned here. They really figured out what they were doing on this record with that sound. It is also the last record to include Alan Myers on drums. Man is a human metronome. Most of the drums on here.
Number 66 is The Muffs by The Muffs. I have a lot of self-titles on my list. A lot of people would probably pick Blonder and Blonder, but this is the one I went for mainly because it's the first one I listened to all the way through. This was their debut album. It was released on Warner Records during the grunge explosion. The Muffs have a more raw pop punk vibe to them than what was coming on the radio at the time. This is their only album as a four-piece. The band would continue as a trio after Melanie Vammen would leave the group. Kim Shattuck passed away last year from ALS, and the world lost one of the best punk songwriters in history. I don't think the Muffs get nearly the credit that they deserve. I think they were overshadowed by more mainstream artists like No Doubt and Hole, but Kim was doing the Courtney Love voice before Courtney Love ever was, so... In a better way, so I don't want to deter anyone from thinking that's a bad thing, but...
At number 65, Archers of Loaf, Achy Metal. Love the rest of Archers of Loaf's discography, but every time I go to listen to them, I get stuck on this record. I hear that pop, pop, pop of the snare drum at the beginning of Web in Front, and I am just hooked. This record is everything that Chapel Hill indie rock is, or was. Too noisy to be played on the radio, too smart for the nerds to call it punk. It's pretty much a punk record, come on. I love every skewed note. Every squeaky seesaw guitar, the shaky, howling, overlapping vocals. I love the self-consciousness and angst of the lyrics and how that all translates into the dissonance and cacophony of this record. And it's still really tuneful and catchy and poppy. It's everything that Pavement and Built to Spill wanted. You can keep those bands. I'm fine with Arches of Love.
Number 64 is Naked Ray Gun's Jettison. We recently talked about this album a little bit when we discussed the year 1988 on our Bad Religion episode with Andy from Five Iron. This is Naked Ray Gun's third album, and they are a Chicago group, and they have that unique Chicago sound that is a combination of melody and buzzsaw guitars. Some people say All Rise is their best, but really, it's apples and oranges. I mean, not even apples and oranges. It's just like saying 1A and 1B. So I come to Jettison more often. It probably comes from the incredible opening track, Soldier's Requiem. The starting riffs hook you immediately. And then you get Jeff's woes and oh hey hoes. And I'm stuck in. I'm good. I'm on this record all the way through to the end, regardless. It's from an era where melodicism wasn't necessarily appreciated in punk. And Naked Ray Gun were doing it perfectly. Wow, I have a lot of time left. I did want to say this before we go on to the next one. As I was writing my notes for this show, I wrote my notes from this album a while ago, but I recently saw this week that Pierre from Naked Ray Gun has recently been diagnosed with cancer, and Anxious and Angry put up two shirts. One is a Naked Ray Gun tribute shirt, actually two Pierre specifically, and then the other one is a Peg Boy shirt. So look, all the money on those shirts I think is going to help out his medical bills. So get well soon, Pierre. Hopefully you can kick this shit out of it. So
all right. Moving on, number 63, I picked Radioactivity, self-titled debut. Radioactivity is half of the Marked Men, which is a band that was kept secret from me when I was discovering punk, and I'm very bitter about that. This is so much of what I love about punk rock, just driving fast downstroke guitars, just high speed, and all of that guided by a sticky, sweet, syrupy melodies mean absolute earworms. This record has this like focused mid-range that really has this nostalgic feeling to me. It reminds me of listening to Adam Ant on our stereo at home as a kid. It's just it's a feeling that goes deep into my core. And I love this record.
Yeah, plenty of time on that one.
Yeah.
Short. Okay. Sweet. Yeah. Coming in at number 62, I have Rites of Spring by Rites of Spring, another self-titled. This is my favorite album from the Fugazi family tree, maybe. I don't know. And that'll change next week. Along with Embrace, Rites of Spring were the originators of the Revolution Summer vibe. Dig Nasty, I believe, is the other key band in that sound. This is my favorite sound in all of hardcore. We only ever get one new band that sounds like this every couple of years. And very few actually come closer to Rites of Spring. They tend to lean more Embrace. I'm not the biggest lyrics guy in the sense that I often don't know what the song is saying. But there are so many lines on this record that are stuck in my head. If I started crying, would you start crying? I woke up this morning with a piece of my past caught in my throat, and then I choked. You know, like, there's all these, like, one-off lines on this record that just are embedded in the soul of punk or emo. Yeah.
All right. Number 61, Elvis Costello's My Aim is True. I understand why it's not properly classified as a punk classic. It's more of a rock record, and it's probably more important to New Wave, but you can't tell me that The Clash and The Damned weren't listening to this flawless debut. Just check out the records that they made immediately after. You've got these doo-woppy ooh-ahs and hand claps and little bits of Buddy Holly's rock and roll. You've got Southern Soul and funk butting up against proto-punk and New Wave, like I said. It's a perfect power pop record. Elvis Costello has this uncanny knack of populating his songs with these really anxious, neurotic creeps and goons, and it's just dripping with acrid social commentary. Miracle Man has one of my favorite riffs of all time. Allison is just the stunning ballad.
Number 60 is the B-52's Wild Planet.
Living in your own private Idaho. Living in your own private Idaho.
I had a friend tell me one time that he couldn't listen to the B-52s, but I could listen to the B-52s. Like, in the sense that I don't know if he was worried about his image or something, but he thought it was okay for me to listen to the B-52s. I don't know what he thinks that means, but he's missing out on some amazing songwriting. Wild Planet is the second album by the B-52s. This album doesn't feature the kitschy hits like Love Shack or Rock Lobster. Instead, it kind of has some of their more mature-sounding songs. So this record features Private Idaho and Give Me Back My Man, which are absolutely incredible songs. It doesn't quite have the standout single like some of the other records do, but if you've written off the B-52s as a singles band, then, like I said, you're missing out on an incredible record. I recommend this and the first.
All right, number 59, I mentioned The Dam. Well, this is that record. Machine Gun Etiquette heavily borrows from Elvis Costello, for sure. I saw someone say this over London Calling, and that's that, and I have to agree. Nobody had more absolutely gonzo fun with punk rock than The Damned in the 70s. I mean, you've got psych freakouts and mod rock beats and the whole thing. It feels like it's laying the groundwork for Husker Du's magnum opus to me. I mean, there's a cover of an MC5 song that I think is better than the original. There's just that riff on the title track. You know it when you hear it. I love the trashy drums. I love Dave Vanian's Dracula voice. That goofy organ shouldn't work, but it does. It's such a catchy record, and there are all these little details tucked in between and in the backgrounds.
Switching gears, number 58 is Majority Rules Emergency Numbers. This was released between Interviews with David Frost and the Document Number 12, split with Page 99. This is my favorite Majority Rule album, though. It's not often that an album that features an over 7-minute song is my favorite, but here we are. the song It's Too Late, which then transitions perfectly into American Feature. Incredible. This entire album kind of feels like one large piece of music, yet each track can be taken out on its own and appreciated by itself. But this isn't a record that you're going to just pick one song off of. You're going to play Emergency Numbers from beginning to end. Matt Michelle's vocals are the gnarliest I've ever heard in a screamo band, and they're an odd band too because they don't necessarily fit all the tropes of screamo, but they're absolutely incredible. I saw them a few years ago live with Page 99, and it was mind-blowing in all the best ways. Some of the members have a new band called No Man. Yeah, they're good too.
We're almost halfway. Mm-hmm. All right, number 57 is Roadside Monuments, 8 hours away from being a man. The second of three LPs by the band. Seattle's ostensibly Christian rock answer to Midwest emo. They shed that second guitarist from the first record, and they made a bigger sounding record as just a three-piece. Like, very little overdubs, extreme dynamic range. It's this sprawling post-rock, math rock, noise rock, emo core masterpiece. One of the highest points of, I think, any of those genres, and not a lot of people have heard it. I don't know. I guess blame it on Tooth and Nail and all of that association. But the rhythm section of Jonathan Ford and Matt Johnson would be thrilling to listen to on their own. But you match that up with Doug Lurick doing this sort of Silkworm, Shipping News, good enough vocal and some sloppy guitar work.
Ended on sloppy guitar work.
Yep. The best one.
Number 56 is Navio Forge, As We Quietly Burn a Hole Into. It would be so easy to include every single Sarah Kirsch band on this list. I love every project she was ever involved with, but my absolute favorite has to be Navio Forge. This band consisted of Sarah Kirsch and her Fuel bandmate Aaron Arroyo, as well as Sean Linwood from the emo core band Admiral. Navio Forge is one of the most passionate emo core bands that I've ever heard, and that's saying something considering Right to Spring exists. The band only played two shows before breaking up because the performances were so emotionally intense and draining that they just couldn't do it anymore. I believe it's Sean Linwood. He kind of disappeared after this record. It's the only thing they ever recorded, which is a shame because he is a phenomenally good vocalist. And I would like to dig that guy up off the internet and try and just be like, hey, man, you want to do something new? because you're too good.
Number 55, it is the Feelies and the Good Earth. I guess the obvious choice would have been Crazy Rhythms, which is this nervy, complex post-punk record. But I listened to this one more. It just cuts a little bit deeper for me. Kind of reminds me of Big Star in the way that Alex Chilton's vocals are really buried. But I can really just bob my head along to this one and mumble along with Glenn Mercer, who kind of sounds a little bit like Jay Farrar to me. But really, though, there's the precedence to Uncle Tupelo is more out. Stands out more to me than any parallels to REM or whatever jangle pop is. Just these fuzzy, rubbery lead guitar parts and Peggy Sue rolling tom drums. It's a killer record, and I think more people should hear it.
Right. At number 54, I have MU330's Crab Rangoon. We talked a lot about MU330 and Dan Podhass during our Skogist celebration, so I don't know how much more I can add to that we haven't said already. I will say this is probably my favorite MU330 album, and it's probably in my top five of favorite ska records, period. This was the first album with Dan on lead vocals for the entire record. This one has Christmas Card, Tune Me Out, Ireland, Neighbor, all classics. Came out in 1997 during the ska explosion. It's considered a classic by ska fans, but doesn't really have much mainstream appreciation. It's highly recommended if you haven't heard it before, but we've definitely preached the gospel of MU330 a lot on this show before, so I yield my time.
At number 53 is Dark Blues, Pure Reality. I think we talked a good bit about this record when we did our decade recap, but I feel like it's worth mentioning again. This record is irritable, angry, sharp, and super catchy. John Sharkey is a prickly dude, but he has got some sweet, sweet hooks lodged in his craw. Kind of sounds like, you know, The Cure a little bit, but punker. This record is just great when you're pissed off at the world, but you also want to sing along.
Okay, number 52, I have Coalesce 012 Revolution in Just Listening. I don't know how you're supposed to say this name of this record, but Sean Ingram has one of the sickest sounding voices in all of hardcore, and not just like sick as in man, that's sick, but like sick as in he actually sounds ill sometimes. While everyone else seemed to pick Dillinger Escape Plan or Botch or Converge in the mathcore wars of the early 2000s, I always preferred Coalesce. Sean's voice combined with Jess Steininger's crazy, like rubbery riffs, who, by the way, is the most insane guitar player I've ever seen live. Nathan Ellis holds the frame of the song together while Jess has a freak out with his guitar, but then James keeps time with some of the weirdest time signatures I've heard in a hardcore band. They are the total package for me, and this is the best assortment of songs that they have compiled together as a single album.
Number 51, you said their name a second ago, Converge, You Fail Me. This is my choice from the Mathcore Wars. I'm picking this record. I think that the legacy of Jane Doe has really overshadowed it, and not many people have given it enough credit. It's my personal favorite Converge record. It really balances everything that they're known for. I mean, you've got crunchy, thrashy, pre-Jane style riffs. You've got Bannon's shark dog, cathartic shrieking. All these chromatic runs and blocky dissonant chords and rivet pounding factory line drumming. Like it's just nonstop. There's, you know, a dip into some Neurosis kind of post-sludge sounds and a little bit of a new mode of voice for Bannon on a couple of these tracks. I don't know. The first
Number 50 is Amateur Parties Truncheons in the Manor.
Kelly's the band you want that you rent it. What's in my day, boy? You're gonna get it. Fucking on a fake ID. Cause I won't never play that easy. Trying to ride the R5's blood book. Seem to stop these twice and we want more. But I can't drive. Feel free to back stage. Even though we don't look right. I've been thinking real good thoughts about you. Singing real good songs about you, written by you.
I know I've already picked Armalite earlier, but that was a super group, so I feel like I could pick another Mike McKee band. This is his other real big... Well, I guess Kill the Man of Questions was kind of the other big band, but instead of hardcore, this time Mike is playing this really cool brand of post-punk that borrows from Gang of Four, the Minutemen, and the Jam. So it's jangly in like the best ways possible. The band features Steve Roche from Off Minor and Satia, and Jeff Ziga, mentioned above, and has some extra vocals from Emily, JK, and Nicole Enriquez. Their voices are phenomenal together. This album is incredibly catchy, and I love Mike's like triple strum that he does on nearly every song on the guitar. Amateur Party is incredibly underrated, and I want more people to listen to this album because it's very unheard.
Number 49, I have the Warriors' debut, Imaginary Life. Lauren D'Annunzio has kind of snuck into my top 10 of current songwriters in punk. In 2015, I listened to this record a couple times, but then I kind of quietly let it slip from my regular rotation, and I was a dummy for that. I've listened to their follow-up even less, and I kept putting them on my fest schedules, and I think last year you or I persuaded the other to go see them, and I felt goosebumps. Just an incredible band. I revisited this record earlier this year on a stretch of California Highway at night between Bakersfield and Fresno, and it's going to make my personal collection, permanent collection. And then, of course, the new record is incredible, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it later this year.
Number 48, another lesser-known band. We have Avoid One Thing's Chopstick Bridge. Avoid One Thing is the side project of the Mighty Mighty Bosstones bassist Joe Gittleman. He also performs the majority of the vocals in the record and the albums. It also features Amy Griffin from Darkbuster and the Raging Teens on guitars and vocals. And this was their second album and the first one after their previous drummer, Dave Karsich, who passed away. It's a mid-tempo punk album. It's full of these like melancholy tunes with some amazing guitar parts and melodies. Avoid One Thing are another criminally underlooked band. They imprinted kind of a skeleton on the type of punk songs that will become my favorites over the years. And a good chunk of the punk stuff that you see on my rest of my list is very in the same vein as this one, but underrated, very underrated record.
All right, at 47, I put Pup's self-titled debut. I originally selected their sophomore effort from the Toronto band, but I had to go with my heart. Their debut is a little bit shaky, sure, but there's just something really special and endearing about this record. Justin convinced me and our friend Corey to go see them at Fest, and it was a performance that I'll always remember. I mean, pummeling, chunky riffs, Steph Babcock's atonal shouting, and these killer jazzy guitar solos and soaring choruses. It's a killer record full of little harmonious flourishes and big heavy riffs and some really aggressive lyrics.
Number 46 is Sam I Am's Astray. It's rare that a band's sixth album is one of their best, but Sam I Am are one of those bands that I think gets better over time. There will be some occasional catches in their stride, but they tend to make up for it with the next record. Catch Me on the Right Day, I Might Say Trips, is even my favorite record. I fell in love with Sam I Am because of the song Mud Hill. So this was the first full length that I seeked out by them, just because, you know, you're gonna pick the one that you know the song from. It also has Dull and Sunshine, which easily makes it one of their greatest albums in their discography, and that's just a couple of the tracks on the record. It's their last record with James Brogan on guitar after being on every record previous, and it's a perfect record for him to go out on. Just a genuinely perfect emo alternative rock record from the 2000s, I think.
At 45 is Colosseum's House with a Curse. But this is the point where Ryan Patterson's true inner goth came out of the shadows. This record sounds like a hybrid of Sisters of Mercy and the first two Danzig records and the Wipers. Stonery, bluesy, space rock riffs and post-punk vamping and esoteric lyrics and brooding stentorian vocals all mixed together by Jay Robbins and his incredible ears. It was a jarring jump from the previous record, which was a lot thrashier, but this is where I think Ryan really hit his stride as a songwriter, as a riff writer, and just as a band leader in general. Seeing them play this record was incredible.
Number 44 is Motion City Soundtrack's Commit This to Memory. I feel like I've talked about this record a lot recently, but I don't know. Does anyone else have any of those bands where you only listen to one album they released and nothing else by them? Commit This to Memory is one of those albums for me. Not that their other music is bad, it just doesn't hit in the same way that this record does. Maybe it's because this album was written during a pretty important period in Justin Pierre, the vocalist songwriter's life. He was seeking help for his alcohol abuse, and then he was also trying to channel Tom Waits, Ben Folds, and John K. Samson in his writing style. And that's kind of evident, because he wanted their storytelling approach to songwriting, and it does show in this album. I have a tradition to listen to this album on New Year's Day, primarily because two of the songs mention New Year's and are named after it, but the album was also recorded around that time of the year when it was done, so, yeah.
All right, at 43, it's Hot Water Music and Forever and Counting. When it's January in Phoenix, and it's 70 degrees, and I'm driving around with my windows open, not at all missing the East Coast and the cold and the wet and the winter, I reach for a record like this. I reach for Hot Water Music. I just see sunshine and palm trees, and I want to drink cheap beer and play guitar. Hot Water Music is the distillation of the sound of so many of really their peers. I mean, the gravel of Leatherface, the sway and swagger of Jawbreaker and Fuel, even the complexity of hardcore and what metalcore was doing at the time, but all mixed into this drunken, sloppy, loud, incredible sound. And it's really the cornerstone of a lot of the punk that I love.
Number 42, I have Bear Trade's Blood and Sand. Oof. Bear Trade were a punk rock band from Sunderland in the northeastern of England. They released two albums on Dead Broke and Everything Sucks Records. They play the Iron Sheik style of mid-tempo melodic punk that was super popular at the beginning of the 2010s. The Letterman influence was very large. But they were also obviously influenced by fellow Sunderland band Leatherface and Scotland's Broccoli, underrated band if you've never checked them out. They're made up of members of a dozen other bands, none of them quite as melodic as Bear Trade. The choruses on this album are infectious, and I love when I can hear a British band's accent come through in their singing. It happens so rarely. I probably listened to this album more than any other in 2014, and I was incredibly happy to see them perform at Fest the 1 year before they broke up.
All right, at 41 is Froda's final album, their posthumous swan song, and We Washed Our Weapons in the Sea, kind of a diversion for the band, which was known for incredibly spazzy, noisy, hardcore. The DC Underdogs took a little bit of a turn. They kind of sound like a fusion of At the Drive-In and Refused in that millennium post-hardcore sound. This record has incredible bass work by Nathan Burke. It's one of the standouts of the record, and Jason Hammaker's drumming is also incredible. I kind of consider this a record that radicalized me as a young kid. It is chock full of apocalyptic imagery, and it is unfortunately relevant.
Number 40, we have Sleater-Kinney's Call the Doctor. About their favorite Sleater-Kinney albums, but this one's my favorite. This was their second album, and Corin Tucker and Carrie Brownstein's first after they left their previous band, so this became their full-time job, essentially. It's unmistakably punk rock, but indie rock tries to steal it and claim it as their own. This record is too raw to be considered indie rock. They have a very unique rhythm to most of their music. The drums and guitars are often not on the same beat, but they're still in time with each other, almost working more like a locomotion type rotation. But I didn't really get into Sleater-Kinney until in the last couple of years, but they quickly turned into one of my favorite bands of all time. So it's, yeah, this album features I Want to Be Your Joey Ramone. So, I mean, how could I not pick this one over the others? But they're all great.
All right, at 39, it's Fugazi, and this is a hot take, but my favorite is Steady Diet of Nothing. It's just their best, without a doubt. I mean, Repeater is great, those first two EPs are classics, but this, to me, really exemplifies everything that the band was trying to do. There's a lot of experimentation here that precedes what they would do a lot on their remaining records, but it's really well balanced with their earlier sound. They took this democratic approach to making this record, so everyone's levels are really right at the same level. They don't like it, but I do. You can hear what everyone's doing, and it feels like a statement on what Fugazi set out to be, even though that was maybe not actually the intention. Guy's performances on this are my favorite of his, other than Rites of Spring.
Number 38, we have X-Hex, It's Real. This is the most recent album on my list. Someone I follow on Twitter said the riffs on this album were great, and so I checked it out because of that. It was released on Merge Records. It subsequently became my most played album of 2019, and this is the record that turned me into a Mary Timoney fan, especially of her band Helium. One of the few modern bands that I would actually call power pop. That term gets thrown around too much for my liking. But the guitar lines on this album feel like they came out of a time warp from the 70s. It's got this big rock and roll feel, The melodies are incredible on here. The reviews for the album weren't as high as I expected them to be, oddly. But who gives a shit? Because this album is fucking phenomenal. They're all incredibly talented musicians, and it works more as a collective, too, than like a straight-up band of like who this is what each member does. But Mary's a legend, and we should appreciate her.
All right, at number 37 is American Steel's last LP, Dear Friends and Gentle Hearts. We've talked about them already on this show, but I love this band, so let's do it again. Dear Friends and Gentle Hearts is one of the most carefree, feel-good sounding, timeless pop-punk classics. The guitars are sickeningly sweet. There's just killer licks all over. The bass is excellent. I mean, melodic reinforcement, not just, you know, playing the root. Great playing all over. There's just this sassy sneer to the vocals that I absolutely adore, and I blow out my voice every single time I listen to American Steel. And I mean, it's not just the catchiness, the lyrics have a lot of meaning to them, and it's easy to yell along with them. I mean, it's that garagey Americana sound.
Number 36 is Summer Vacation's Condition. I have been championing Summer Vacation since the split they did with Joyce Manor. And in fact, anytime someone mentions Joyce Manor, I have to tell them that they stole their whole sound from Summer Vacation, a fact that Joyce Manor has admitted themselves. they are another band on the I Think We Should Stay Away From Each Other comp, which, now that I think about it, probably should have been on my list. I didn't think about comps at all, but that comp means a lot to me. It's fuzzy as hell. It's catchy, despite not being the easiest to sing along with. Condition was their only full-length album before one of the members left the band and they changed their name to Winter Break. Every time I re-listen to it, I'm still impressed with how good this album is. I talked about it a bunch on our Best of the 2010s episode, but I will continue talking about how good Condition is and Summer Vacation. You should listen to them.
All right, number 35 is Galaxy 500's On Fire. Memories of listening to the other two records on either side of this one on a drive up to San Francisco, up to PCH, and back home. This band really nails a vibe that I was trying to cultivate last year, and they are just a perfect sounding band. Damon's drums are really well balanced and punchy. Naomi's bass is just barely there, but it really lends to the mystique of the band. And Dean's voice is shitty, and I love it. Just that terrible falsetto, it makes me feel like such a coward as a vocalist. And it's not all just texture and sparse arrangement.
For number 34, I have Zeo's Liberate Te Exinferis. The first Zeo song I ever heard was Trash Can Hands, and it was on the This Is Solid State Volume 2 compilation, and I hated it. I was a little young and didn't quite get this kind of music fully, but then when I got older and learned that Self-Titled had a weird production value and these strange electronic drums on it, and even the band themselves do not like that song, that I was like, oh, okay, I probably was misjudging Zeo. It would take Funeral of God for me to really become a fan. But this was the first one I think I bought, but I may not be right. I may have gone into it 100%, not 100% sure to you that I was even going to like it. But my mind was blown. Savannah, Autopsy, Skin Like Winter, Ghost Psalms. These are classics in the Zayo discography and that are still played to this day. This is the first Zayo album with Scott Mellinger on guitars, and it is also the only record to feature Scott, Dan, Russ, and Jesse together on the same record. The rest, yeah.
At number 33 is Hot Snakes Audit in Progress. Every riff I try to write turns into a John Reese ripoff. He's a rock and roll guitar wizard. This record sounds like a jet taking off, circling the airport, crashing into the middle of your skull 12 times in a row. There's this hard pan guitars from Reese and Rick Froberg that cuts my brain in half. It's so fun to try and keep track of what everyone's doing. I love Mario Rubalcaba's heavy, heavy tom grooves and Garwood's bass. It's just my kind of knuckle-dragging Neanderthal rock music. It's every song on here is like an anthem for everything that you hate. Your job, maybe a shitty relationship, maybe your town, maybe the gatekeepers in your scene. Tell them all to shove it with Audit in Progress.
For number 92, I have Five Iron Frenzies, our newest album ever. Five Iron was my favorite band from the age of 13 up until my mid-20s. I remember buying all the hype that the Your Money Can Buy came out in the year it came out. And then getting Upbeats and then the first live album. So by the time I got to our newest album ever, I was already familiar with 7 out of the 13 tracks due to the live album. And it still became my favorite album, like, instantly. For the longest time, this was my favorite album of all time. It has the funniest songs. It has the best lyrics on serious songs. It has their show closer, Every New Day, which might be the first song to make me cry when I heard it. I think it's their final performance on The End Is Here that specifically triggered that emotion, but... I've gone on to other favorite bands since then, but Five Iron is always going to be one of my favorites, and I'm going to keep them in a special place.
All right. Number 31 is Ramones' Subterranean Jungle. The Ramones have more crowd-pleasing, historically significant, and critical favorite records than any other punk band from the classic period, and they have just as many more criminally underrated, earworm-infested pop-punk masterpieces in their catalog. This is my personal favorite. Of course, you know, the first four are objectively indispensable, but for me, songs like Outsider, Highest Trails Above, those are top 10 songs for me. Check out the opening track, Little Bit of Soul, and try to get that Motown bass line and cowbell and hand clapping out of your head. This is the Ramones really at their prime, I think, and I will always cherish it.
Number 30, I have selected the Stiff Little Fingers' Inflammable Material. Green Day. I became a fan of the Stiff Little Fingers because of the 10 seconds of Suspect Device that is played in the movie High Fidelity. I bought this CD in college and listened to it for the first time all the way through in the car with my girlfriend at the time, and I distinctly remember her hating the song Closed Groove. She basically yelled at me in the middle of the song, "You don't have to listen to every song on the album." And the album was almost over. Getting to see them play at best and a majority of the tracks on this record. I don't think they played the entire thing. And hearing Jake Burns tell the stories about the recording of this album is absolutely amazing. This is my favorite 70s punk album, period. Stiff Little Fingers are not as loved as some of the bigger UK punk bands, probably because they're sort of outsiders from being from Northern Ireland. But
all right. Number 29, Alkaline Trios, God Damn It. I picked their debut LP out of all the other records in their catalog that I love so dearly just because of that powerful off-the-cuff demo quality. Just this Hot Water Music-esque, drunken shouting, the breakneck pace of the whole thing almost nonstop, other than maybe an acoustic song. I love all of these little things, like there's this panning tom fill on Cringe, the siren sounds and pick scraping on Cop, and when Matt varies up the chorus and says, "Why did you become a cop? Shut the fuck up." It's just an exciting record from beginning to end. We make fun of our friend Corey because for the longest time he only had this and like the Weaker Thans in his CD changer, but honestly, I get it. I mean, I get stuck on this record all the time.
It's just Pieball and it's just goddamn it in the Weaker Thans. Number 28, I selected Piebald, We Are the Only Friends We Have. I didn't figure out I liked the band Piebald until after they broke up. Then I kicked myself for waiting so long to get into them. I've always found Piebald fans in the least suspecting places. One of multiple friends in college, I learned many months after knowing them that they liked Piebald. Everyone agrees that We Are the Only Friends is their best album. Of course, this record has American Hearts on it. And hey, you're part of it. But it also has King of the Road, Simple Plan, The Stalker. When they reunited a couple years ago, we got to see them twice. And I'm so happy they reunited because they play a majority of this record live still. I would like to hear some songs from the last two records, but too much piano, I guess. This is an album where you wind up singing along with every word. It's one of those, yeah.
All right, number 27 is Jesus and Mary Chain's Stoned and Dethroned. Kind of a hot take here. I have this little thing that I wrote. The officer who pulled me over for failing to maintain my lane last year is far from the first person to express disbelief at my confession to have never used marijuana even once in my life. I mean, he really went, ever? Nothing against it. Smoke it if you got it, but doesn't appeal to me. Yet Stoned and Dethroned makes me want to roll a joint and drive to some distant corner of Arizona. They left the shinny pedals off. This is like the least fuzzy Jesus and Mary Chain record. It's just dreamy pop with acoustic guitars and 12 strings, and it's everything that I have grown to love in the last couple of years.
Dylan's always talking at me about the Jesus and Mary Chain. Number 26, The English Beat, I Just Can't Stop It. We talked about the beat extensively on the IRS Records bracket. They didn't win the whole thing, spoiler alert, but they got close. So I'll be a little more specific about this record. This is the first beat song I ever heard, maybe, that I have memory of ever hearing, is Ranking Full Stop. So when it came time to pick which beat album I would listen to first, it was obviously this one. Turns out it's also their fastest album and their most what you would describe as two-tone. Other albums would borrow more from like new wave and soul and other aspects of Caribbean music. This record also features Tears of a Clown, A Mirror in the Bathroom, which is two of their biggest pop hits. So it has a combination of the more traditional ska, reggae, two-tone, and the more pop sensibilities. And it even has dubbed songs with Twist and Crawl and my favorite anti-Margaret Thatcher song ever, Stand on Margaret.
Number 25 is the ultimate mysterious guy punk record, Over the Edge by Wipers.
Just
This is one of my Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul records. It's just spooky and eerie. I love to drive around at night listening to it. I distinctly remember locking up my art house theater job and getting in my car and just driving around listening to this record before going home. This, to me, is the sound of driving across the Mojave Desert, struggling to keep my eyes open, and Greg Sage is just howling somewhere in space about now is the time and where is the truth and living in the doom town and screaming for Juliet. It's alienation distilled into rockabilly riffs and grainy distortion and reverb, and I love it. I hope my ghost haunts the highways of America driving around listening to this record.
Man. Number 24, I selected Coheed and Cambria's In Keeping Secrets of Silent Earth 3. Coheed has the worst album titles of all time. They are an incredibly polarizing band. I think there are three types of people. They're the hardcore fans who are supremely devoted to them. They love every record they put out, and I have a friend like this who actually will resequence albums just because he likes it better that way. then there's those people who just love the first two or three albums and then kind of stop listening after that. And then finally, there are the people who just hate Claudio's voice. Understandable. It's a very unique voice. I chose this album because it is the best blend of their brand of emo with prog rock elements. Even though these songs are pretty long, I've always loved Claudio's voice as well, so that managed to carry me through the songs. One of my best friends since college is a huge Coheed fan, and his love of them made me take a chance on them when I was getting into emo after college, and they are the silliest band I love.
At number 23 is Jawbreaker's 24-Hour Revenge Therapy. Whenever I listen to this record, I am mentally transported back to the summer after my freshman year of college, where I would sit in the yard and just listen to mopey songs and mope and wait until I could go back to school. I find myself reliving other mopey times in my life, unemployed after being fired from my first adult job, bitter and angry, walking around a few years later in Winston-Salem and feeling like I had no idea what to do with my life. But all of that gets poured out on this record, and I feel a little bit less alone. And it's a great record when you feel sad and at your lowest to just sit and lick your wounds.
My number 22 is Jimmy Eat World's Bleed American. Like Commit This to Memory, Bleed American is really the only Jimmy Eat World album I listen to. They have other good songs in other albums, but this is the only one that I listen to from beginning to end. I bought this CD on clearance when Circus City, where service is state of the art, was going out of business, because our friend Grant, who runs Builder Melody, told me to get it. So it became one of my favorite albums, and one that I would listen to on repeat the most. I can always listen to this album from beginning to end. You start it up and it will go. One of my favorite memories about this record is blasting it in the car with Grant and Matt Evans from Old Flings, with us singing along at the top of our lungs on the way to Fest. It's perfect. My wife even likes this album, and she doesn't care about my music. So,
number 21, I picked Gaslight Anthem's Handwritten. I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is their best written record. I mean, it doesn't have that scrappy upstart charm of their debut. It doesn't have the gimmicky magic tricks of the 59 sound. But it does have a very confident, well-learned, and well-worn voice, Brian Fallon, right up front. You've got this soul punk rhythm section at full tilt and some sweet, sweet guitar leads from Alex Rosamilia. It's workmanlike in a lot of ways, but I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think if you're going to go out and try to make a rock record, this is the workbook for you. If you're trying to wring out any more sweat and blood from rock and roll, it's really hard to improve on this.
Number 20 is Dead to Me's Cuban Ballerina. Speaking of singing at the top of your lungs, I have seen Dead to Me no less than 5 times, maybe more. And every time I came away hoarse because I blew my voice out shouting along. America Steel is the only other band that really matches the amount of shouting I do with a record. This is the only full length with Jack. He left soon after the Little Brother EP came out, and he came back after Moscow Penny Ante. So he's back in the band. They have new songs, supposedly. To me, Jack and Chicken have the best double vocals of any punk band, and I mean that because they're even Chuck and Chris from Hot Water Music don't quite match Jack and Chicken. It's weird to say their names together. Everyone knows who I know who likes Dead to Me adores this record. Yeah.
At number 19 is Teenage Fan Club's Grand Prix, the third record from the Scottish power pop group. From that first shimmery chiming guitar strum and tightly harmonized opening hook, I start grinning. I have spent whole days humming the melodies of Sparky's Dream and Neil Jung, and just as much time trying to say verisimilitude correctly. I bought an MXR microamp pedal to pair with my rat because I wanted to be like Norman. I love his Neil Young-y guitar solos. And while Gerard is usually not my favorite of the band's songwriters, I think he gets the highest marks on this record for me. Almost all of my favorites are his songs. This is a band that stuck to their formula and perfected it and polished it to a brilliant sheen.
Number 18, the Aquabats Charge with 2 exclamation points. Again, if you listen to our Skoggist episodes, you know that the Aquabats are one of our favorite bands. Interestingly, though, my favorite album by them is their least ska sounding. Leaning heavy into their Devo influences, Charge was recorded after the band had whittled down to a 5-piece, and it's their most focused album. Fashion Zombies, Stuck in a Movie, Nerd Alert, Look at Me, I'm a Winner. Every song on this album has a massive hook and avoids some of the more indulgent elements of the other Aquabats records. It's just like a slick pop rock album about crime fighting aliens from Aquabania, and that's it.
Are you sure you've got more time? At number 17 is Husker Du's Zen Arcade, one of my favorite records of all time. There's a line in the movie Almost Famous that goes, "Listen to Tommy with a candle burning and you'll see your entire future." That's how I feel about this record. I mean, admittedly, that's pretty bleak vision of the future considering, but I love this record so dearly. It really shouldn't be possible to take the sound of 80s hardcore and stretch it out over 70 minutes of loose narrative concept record, pepper it with acoustic guitars and pianos and psychedelic tape reverse and Hare Krishna chants to the tune of I Love Candy, or I Want Candy, sorry, and still retain a compelling sense of urgency. I mean, this is just a spiteful, angry, voice lacerating, fuzzed out, glass shattering record.
Number 16, Jets to Brazil, Perfecting Loneliness. Steve doesn't said that he could erase Perfecting Loneliness from the Jets to Brazil discography and be happy, and I have a very strong opinion against that. I think, ready for my hot take, I think Perfecting Loneliness is better than any Jawbreaker album. I know it's very spicy, but this album hits me way down in that sweet crossover of melancholy and nostalgia. When I listen to this album, I think of driving through the mountains and walking in the fallen leaves. The oranges and browns of the album cover, plus the song Autumn Walker, makes this my perfect fall album. No album puts me in such a specific frame of mind as this one. It's a weapon that must be utilized selectively because I don't want to abuse it, so it's no longer effective. But we're nearing that time of year where it's Perfecting Loneliness time. So,
why would you get rid of Perfecting Loneliness? Four Cornered Night's the worst Jets to Brazil record.
Hey, take it up with Steve.
At number 15 is Gold by Starflyer 59.
Stand there in time, like I remember.
Christian indie rock, basically solo project. This record is a little bit more shoegaze and slowcore, what they were known for early on. Starflyer is my favorite band, and I think this is my favorite record, probably by any band. I remember getting this CD and thinking it was weird and too slow and really depressing, and I would just alternate between laying on the floor, listening to it, listening to the feedback and Jason Martin's falsetto whisper, and then jamming my CD player in my pocket and walking around our neighborhood, nodding my head to these metallic guitars and shimmery, tremolo, reverb-y strumming. It stuck. I had too much on that one. Trying to hit the highlights.
Number 14, I picked Talking Heads, More Songs About Buildings and Food. I got into the Talking Heads in my mid-20s, during that point in your life where you start checking out Talking Heads. You know, that era where you're like, maybe I should listen to some of these classics that people talk about so much. I started with the greatest hits because, oh, duh, it's their best songs. mainly it's the ones that I heard as a kid growing up and on the radio. More Songs was the first full length that I stumbled across record shopping, and it's the one I go back to most often. Talking Heads are probably one of the most beloved new wave bands. They're also so different from many of their contemporaries. This was before they got really experimental and started including lots of African beats, but then turned into a slick pop group with Speaking in Tongues. This is like the perfect blend of arty plus poppy for me.
Yeah, we're getting into the portion of the list where our tastes probably most overlap. At number 13 is Crowbait's Sliding Through the Halls of Fate. One swampy day in North Carolina, in Carrboro, a barista asked me about my Crowbait shirt. He was too hot in that coffee shop, and he was listening to Earth's Hex of all the records that you could listen to. And I feel like that kind of captures what this record sounds like to me. Obviously, it doesn't sound like Earth, but there's this folky, swampy feeling and a lot of anxiety and feeling put on the spot. These songs are near and dear to me. It's the side project of Mikey Dumps, who's been in a million bands, but you know him best from Iron Sheik. For some reason, this is the one that I go back to the most, probably in large part because it scored a lot of my first trip out west when I flew to Albuquerque and drove to L.A. I listened to this record.
Number 12 is Blenderhead's Figureheads on the Forefront of Pop Culture. This record is so important to us that we named one of our attempts at a blog after it. You may still be able to find that. This album, don't do that. This album came out at a turbulent time for Billy Power and also after the departure of Eben. Because as Billy said, he was jealous that Eben was singing too many songs on the previous record. This is their third album and their most polished. It's inspired by bands like Jawbox and Fugazi. This album is full of like odd time signatures, the choppy DC guitar parts, and like these pulsing bass lines. It's also one of those albums that I would blast in the car and sing along from beginning to end, every word. I used to also drive my ex crazy by playing You Know Who You Are, which is a dissonant off-key song. But Billy was very influential in me wanting to start this podcast, even because of his own show and his music. So, yeah.
Number 11, speaking of Jawbox, For Your Own Special Sweetheart, the album that contains our theme song of the last 2 years. To me, this is the very definition of the heaviest music. It's not all high gain and crushing breakdowns. A lot of times, to me, it's that tension. It's that creaking and straining. It's J. Robin's strangled voice giving out to these soulful baritone choruses, rattling, punching guitars and bending atonal riffs, Kim Coletta's bright, brand new bass strings through a cranked SVT, Zach Barocca's heavy-handed hi-hat counts and really excellent-sounding snare. I can just go on and on about snare sounds. I don't know why. I'm not a drummer, but this record's got a great one.
Home stretch. All right. Number 10, Leatherface, Mush.
Mush.
took me a lot longer than it should have to try out Leatherface. They were always cited as an influence for bands I love, like Dillinger Four and Hot Water Music, and an entire generation of quote-unquote orgcore bands. Frankie Stubbs is the original gruff punk vocalist, but that's also just kind of how he sounds. Their music is more in line with melodic punks like Naked Raygun and Husker Du, just sped up. Mush is Leatherface at their peak. Not that they have any bad records, mind you, but this is when they are their most ferocious and combined with good production. Frankie's vocals combined with Dickie Hammond's incredible guitar lines may be the best combination of sounds in all of punk rock. I find it hard to compare to anyone else. They are their own thing and inspired so many people to do their own thing.
Number 9 is AJJ's Can't Maintain. I'm really glad that I had a little folk punk phase in my life. I'm also glad that the only band that I still listen to from that time period is AJJ. And I'm also really, really glad I've gotten to see this band play in a lot of different places. Shitty bars, little DIY spots, big outdoor stages. They've been one of my favorite bands for a really long time. And while they kind of faded a little bit from my discography, they've risen again. My wife suddenly, finally decided to get into them in the last 3 or 4 years. So it's been really cool to also get to see that someone else exploring this band and getting into this record. Anytime I listen to it, I'm just going to remember Justin's face when I put it on for the first time after it had leaked. I burned a CD and I put it in the CD player.
Finish it.
And we got through Heartilation, and he was like, who is this? AJJ goes electric.
Yeah. This was also right after I made you burn another AJJ album on CD, and I was like, no, I want to listen to this, and you wouldn't let me. Like, no!
Okay.
Number 8. Minutemen, Double Nickels on the Dime. One of the most critically acclaimed punk albums of all time. Probably the most critically acclaimed album on this list. Which is amazing, because the only reason this album is a double LP is because they were goofing on Husker Du. Vietnam, number one hit song. Do You Want a New Wave? A political song for Michael Jackson to sing. Corona, the theme song to Jackass. There's so many amazing songs on this album, which it should, because there are 40-something songs, so you gotta hope some of them are good. But there are a lot of jams and experimental tracks, which in most other bands I don't care about, but this one, it works for me. I can't listen to History Lesson Part 2 without getting just a little bit misty-eyed. The death of D. Boone is the biggest what-if in music history for me. We definitely would have got that triple album. But who knows what else they would have done. They probably would have gone as long as Firehose, honestly. And probably been as iconic or legendary as maybe Dinosaur Jr. So, yeah.
All right, number 7. It's X, Under the Big Black Sun. We talked extensively about X and one of their records. We talked a little bit about this record. This record really ties together a lot of threads for me. Classic punk, my obsession with California and the West, brief teenage flirtations with psychobilly and rockabilly and all the muted permutations of that sound throughout my record collection, and my full-on love of country music. From the get-go, Hungry Wolf was my favorite X song before I even knew it was an X song, thanks to an unlikely Christian rock cover of it by Stavesacre. Motel Room is a perennial playlist road trip song for me. And then there's the doo-woppy ballad Come Back to Me, where Billy Zoom plays the saxophone and DJ Bonebreak plays marimba. And then they do it again with an obscure waltz cover.
Number 6. Lucero, That Much Further West. Not really a punk record. Probably my least punk record on here. But they were punks, so they get a pass. This Lucero is the country band that makes punks like country. They've never released a bad album. Even their weakest album is still full of great songs. When I listen to Lucero, I'm immediately transported to a world. It's a world of diners late at night, red neon lights, chain smoking, sitting around a bonfire, having too much to drink, going on a night drive with no specific destination, a hint of melancholy. That Much Further West was the second Lucero album I bought, and it sucked the wind right out of me. This album is heartbreak in musical form. I listen to this album when I want to write a book or direct a movie about characters trying to make the best out of bad situations, maybe doing things they'll regret. go put on Tears Don't Matter Much and tell me you don't feel something. This is my favorite Lucera record. Tennessee is the agreed upon favorite, but this one just hits for me.
Yeah, we had to fight over who got to do this one and just won. Such a great record. Perfect driving and crying music.
Yeah.
Better than driving and crying.
At number 5, it's Superchunks. Here's Where the Strings Come In. Important bands to enter my discography post-college. Here's Where the String Comes In encapsulates everything I love about Superchunk. Max, too high voice, Jame Wilbur's hooky guitar lines, superbly happy sounding melodies laced with just pure acrimony, and utterly relatable lyrics. When I heard Hyper Enough for the first time, it felt like someone had plugged my over-caffeinated brain into a computer into a guitar amp and then turned it up to 10. I see fall leaves on the sidewalks when I hear Yeah, It's Beautiful Here Too. I feel the unending boredom of driving across Arkansas and Oklahoma when I listen to Detroit Has a Skyline Too. This is a perfect record to air out every lingering frustration.
This is one we had to compromise on due to our next one as well. We each selected both of these bands, but we'd pick different albums. So then we basically were like, well, which one do you care more about having for the band? So this is that other one. My personal favorite Superchunk record is On the Mouth. But number 4 is The Weaker Thans' Left and Leaving. I think The Weaker Thans are having a resurgence right now. And it should be, because they are phenomenal. Everything I said about Lucero applies to the Weaker Thans as well. I'd always liked the Weaker Thans, but something happened in the last 5 years where they click more for me than ever before. Maybe I've finally gotten enough in touch with my emotions to understand these records, and John K. Samson's very verbose but amazing lyric writing. Left and Leaving is an album that brings up so many emotions. The melancholy is there for sure, but John K. Samson touches something deeper. All my favorite lyricists are very visual songwriters, and so they conjure specific things in my mind, whether it's imaginary scenarios or memories. And when I hear The Pamphleteer, I am instantly transported to me and all of my friends circled around Robbie, helping him sing the words to the song because he can't remember all of the lyrics.
Yeah, I think I probably have instruction site. Mm-hmm. I could have done Fallow. I mean,
they're all
the
good.
Weaker Thans are a perfect band. Every record's great.
John's records are great.
At number 3, it's Bear versus Shark. Right Now You're in the Best of Hands, and I'm going to save some breath on the rest of the title. My earliest memories of this band involved dial-up internet and banner ads on pure volume. I associated them with 30 Seconds to Mars and Receiving End of Sirens. I did not listen to them when I should have. They finally found their way into my discography, and I'm so glad they did, because this record is just a jangly, joyful, ecstatic chorus from beginning to end. It's all over the place. You've got tambourines and chaotic drumming and poppy melodies. Mark Pavey's voice to me is one of the most comforting things in the world, and he's shrieking and yelling for most of it. I can't not feel good when I put on this record. I'm immediately transported to a late summer afternoon in the Appalachian Mountains, reading a stack of comics, drinking a bottle of cheer wine, and blasting this record through my windows. I have to get that line in there.
Oh, all right. My last one, number 2, Iron Sheik's Not Like This. I'm sick of all the jokes about Iron Sheik playing and writing the same song over and over again. Mainly because they're not wrong, but why would you want another song? This song is too good. The song that they've been rewriting for 3 albums. I don't know why you want anything different. We saw Iron Sheik play at a house show in Asheville the week this album came out. We already knew then that it was a good record. And then seeing them perform these songs a dozen times since then still has not worn out for me. They've become a punchline for Fest bands, but they are the exact thing I love about Fest and why I continue to go every year. This album has become a little sadder since the passing of guitarist Rob McAllister. I couldn't listen to this album for a while without crying. Now I still cry when I listen to it, but it's just because of what the lyrics are saying about the futility of life. But I've been able to come back to it, and I'm very happy because these songs are absolutely stunning. My favorite record, maybe, ever.
Yeah. Well, we found our way to the last record at number one with a bullet. It's Civil War by Dillinger Four.
And I know that's bad for our image, but I don't give a damn.
Right? I mean, how many times have we mentioned the Fest? Hardly any other record on this list comes as close to laying out the very structure of what punk rock means to me. every whoa-oh, every barbed social and political lyric, those punchy guitar strokes and ringing feedback, raspy, slurring, bittersweet, furious melodic hooks. This was the fourth piece of vinyl I ever bought, and I slapped this thing on my shitty, thrifted direct drive turntable so many times my sophomore year of college. I'm sure my roommate was sick of it. But every word of the Org Corps National Anthem, Gainesville, was locked into muscle memory in my throat years before I even made it to Florida for the first time. I mean, it's just, it's our hymnal.
But who cares? This is the last one. I remember sitting in Grant's car. No, it was Corey's car. And we were listening to this album, and he was like, what is he saying in that one song? The world's so fat. The words don't fit. And there's another misheard lyric on that album, and I can't remember what it was, but that record started a snowball for me to get into probably most of what I'm into musically since then. Introduced me to a whole world of punk records that I hadn't heard before, because I was still kind of a metal kid at that point, and was burned out on it. So, Civil War is very important. And that's it. That's 100 albums and definitely more than 100 minutes, but, you know, as close as we could get. We'll see what this edits down to. I don't know how I'm going to include music in here.
You're going to have to pick the best ones.
I can't put 100 songs on this episode.
10 seconds of a song, maybe.
Yeah. I might have to do my every 10 albums, I'll have to do 10 songs. Clips.
Maybe we can make a playlist.
Yeah. But that's it. We did it. 100 episodes. We're not done.
How, but we did it.
We're not doing 200 albums for the 200th episode. A little much work. My work is not even halfway over at this point. So now I gotta listen to this and edit it and put the music in, which will take longer than it did to record. So I got fun in 2 weeks.
Send us your 100 records.
Yeah. Fuck yeah, Dave. This is your idea.
I really do hope that this wasn't a colossal waste of time and that you got something out of it. All of these records are near and dear to probably both of us, with maybe a few exceptions. I hope this is, I mean, it should definitely give you a very clear picture of our tastes in music. But it was fun to revisit a lot of these records too, because a lot of these, you know, like I said, I've listened to them in the last 5 years, but some of them maybe only 5 years ago. So it was really cool to revisit some of these records and think about what they mean to me. There's so much that was left unsaid just because of our time limits.
But I think the time limits helped point us in a direction of what we needed to say about them. Yeah. But hey, if anybody ever picks one of these albums, we could actually then talk about it even more so on the show. So, I did all the social media stuff up top, so yeah, send us your 100. I would love to see everyone's list of 100. I love lists, hence we made this show. But that'll do it for us. 100 episodes. Here's to 100 more.
Whew.